And our special guest tonight, Lauren Coleman, will be back talking about other creatures and mysteries on this planet. The lake monster in Argentina, huge birds, massive birds, and then also lizard men. Just what are they? Later tonight, we'll open up the phone lines. Perhaps you'll share some stories with us. I'm getting some fast blasts now from people who have seen some of these huge cats, for example. Maybe you've seen what we're talking about. We'll be back. Lauren, what's the latest on this unusual lake monster in Argentina?
Well, what happened on April 17th at a newspaper office in Argentina, an individual dropped an envelope with three photographs of this lake monster that he had said he had taken on April 15th. The photographs, which we can see on, you know, the Coast to Coast website and the Crypto Mundo website, show a creature that looks like it has coils, looks like it has a head with a mouth open and different things like that. It looks pretty typical of what you think about as a lake monster, mm-hmm. but also what you might think about as a toy model put in water, because it seems a little too inflexible, so to speak. You'll notice that in one photograph it's seen a little bit above the water and then going down in. What really bothers me about this is these reports from the this area of Argentina have been around since 1897, and there's been what they used to call brontosaurus expeditions looking for it. So we know that these creatures have been around. They're certainly well documented. They've been seen. But I'm very suspicious of any time when somebody anonymously drops off photographs, doesn't stick around, aren't interviewed. We don't know who this person was.
So no background check?
No background at all. The credibility is absolute zero. And you have really just these photographs in a newspaper that is, of course, interested in publishing them. So it's all a very interesting story. They're somewhat interesting photographs, although in many ways they remind me of the Frank Sherrill photographs that we've seen in Loch Ness in the 1970s, which were well-known fake.
Sure.
So it's not quite kosher.
Well, that's disappointing because it's a great story, isn't it?
It's a great story, and definitely we know that there's some very reliable eyewitnesses. You know, the native peoples down there for over 200 years have been seeing the thing, and, you know, definitely some Westerners have been seeing them since the 1870s.
Well, they need a shot of tourism out there?
Well, it's definitely it's a lake that's on the next to the ski slopes. That are pretty important down there, and they already have a very active tourist, contingent, so they don't need any lake monster for that.
No, I guess not, unless they want to go over the top.
Right.
I have always been fascinated, Lauren, with the stories of thunderbirds, Indian myths of these huge birds. Anything new there?
Well, I guess what is new is that there's a new cryptozoologist down in Texas named Ken Girard, who was giving a talk this week, in fact, in Brownsville, Texas. And Brownsville has a long tradition of these. In 1976, these large birds up and down the Rio Grande were seen. And so I think that certainly with Mark Hall's book on thunderbirds and Ken giving speeches in Texas, we're going to have perhaps some new reports. What's of course going on with the birds is that there's an expedition that left on May 1st looking for the imperial woodpecker. And the imperial woodpecker is the world's largest woodpecker, even bigger than the ivory-billed woodpecker.
How big would he be?
About 14, 15 inches long, and quite a bird that you wouldn't miss. and people have been reporting them in different areas of Mexico. It's supposed to be extinct. It's not supposed to exist anymore. It's supposed to have died out, you know, decades ago, but we're still getting reports. So if you can imagine that there's still these large woodpeckers around. Oh,
can you imagine the sound, Lorne?
I mean,
it's bad enough getting woken up by a small woodpecker.
Right.
This thing would sound like a jackhammer.
So the Thunderbird reports, I think it's getting to be that time of year. It's usually in April and May that we get the reports from the Ozarks up into the Midwest and then in the whole area of Point Pleasant and the Appalachians up through the Black Forest of Pennsylvania. There's certain migration routes every year, and they seem to definitely every April, May, and then in September, November, we get the return of the Thunderbirds.
Do you remember the case just a few years ago of the Cessna pilot in Alaska?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He said that he saw the birds, and he said it was as large as his Cessna, and that was in southwest Alaska. And then what I noticed, and it's almost like the Mothman prophecies in many ways, because within about a week we had the giant earthquake up there, and nobody was talking about the big birds anymore. They were all talking about the earthquake, and it really distracted people from talking about the sightings that were all in the news.
Well, you know how some people have talked about Mothman. They've talked about also seeing a caped person standing on the side of the road. Is it possible, as they zoom by in a truck or a car, they're looking at a Thunderbird, a huge bird, 6 feet tall, just standing at the side of a road?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That, in fact, is how the Mothman stories began. These individuals were driving around the TNT area, and they saw this six-foot-tall creature. And one of the first eyewitnesses told me that she at first thought it was an angel because she saw this creature that it was about 6 feet tall and had these huge wings next to its body. And then she said it started walking towards them, and it wasn't flying yet. It was walking towards them, and then she noticed that it was a large bird. The eyewitnesses in around Point Pleasant never called this the Mothman. That was a newspaper reporter's copy editor's name for it. And so these you know, various things like calling them angels or calling them big birds. And then also it's been pointed out by Mark Hall in his book Thunderbird that some reports of Bigfoot have actually turned into Big Hoot, as he calls them, or these big birds, because they're standing there in a grove of trees using their camouflage, and then all of a sudden they open their wings and take off.
Oh, my God. You imagine walking into that, Lauren, and you see that? For a split second, it's going to give you a heart attack, for crying out loud.
Or time to change your underwear.
Yeah.
Yes.
That might be better than the attack.
People are very scared when they see these things, and for rightful reasons.
Was it you years ago? Did you tell me the story of one plucking up a little kid, and a lady had to swoop at it with a broom?
Oh, yeah, Lawndale, Illinois, 1977, in Logan County. Marlo Lowe and he was out in his front yard playing with a bunch of kids, and all of a sudden along comes these two giant condor-like thunderbirds coming down from Kickaboo Creek. They swoop down, and they pick up Marlo, and they take him about 10 yards in his front yard, and there's about seven adults standing around
screaming,
and he drops them. And my brother, Jerry Coleman, was one of the first people on the case, and he interviewed him, and then I went and saw the family.
Did you believe these people?
Oh, I think they're very credible, down-to-earth Illinois. I'm from Central Illinois. I grew up in Decatur, Illinois.
Oh, absolutely, yep.
I wasn't living there at the time, so I came back to interview them. But they were just common, ordinary folk. They didn't have, and in fact, as I think you and I talked about, Marlo suffered much ridicule, so much that his hair turned gray. People in the school were beating him up, leaving dead birds on their porch. They had absolutely no reason to lie or talk about this. It got them nothing but grief, and, which often happens in some of these more remarkable cases.
Where were the birds taking him?
Where were they taking him?
What do you think? A nest?
To the top of the Bald Hills. That's where they usually take the children.
Oh, my God.
There have been reports of children being taken up. There's been reports, you know, from different places around the world, as well as the Ozarks, of bones of children and bones of dogs and other livestock being found in some of these nests. So we know that, you know, the stories about the cats may be here and there as far as them attacking children, but the stories about the birds taking away Cherokee Indian children and, you know, colonist children and attacking cars, jalopy cars and horses and buggies, those have been there for hundreds of years.
Were they feeding the kids to little birds, to their offspring?
That seems to be part of what's going on, yes.
You think it's still happening?
I think you get some
missing kid reports. Who knows what happened to him?
I think that it's, I mean, 1977 is like yesterday to me, but, I mean, maybe I'm showing my age. But so 1977, that same year, a dog was picked up in Kentucky. You know, these creatures, they come in. They're more frequent in some areas, and they do this little attacks on perhaps animals first. And if they find a child that gets their fancy, they may be attacking them too.
Has anyone ever heard one, Lauren, or recorded them?
There has been some questionable recordings and some films, but not anything that I would want to, you know, go to the bank with yet.
Frightening.
Certainly the sounds are like a high-pitched screech. The way one was described to me, it was like a 400-pound mouse.
A 400-pound mouse.
Yeah.
In order to catch it, you need a pretty big mouse trap then, huh?
Exactly. But the screech is just something terrifying.
How come you cryptozoologists are not getting major government funding to find these creatures? Because I think you could if you had the right backing.
Well, it takes a little bit more evidence. I think that what we're finding in the new modern age is those institutions that used to be, 100 years ago, it was the zoos, it was the museums that were sending out the expeditions to find the gorilla, to find the okapi, to find the next coelacanth. And what's interesting to me now is it's the documentary film companies, it's, you know, the media that actually is funding some research, but unfortunately it's 4 or 5 day expeditions. And there's not that kind of money around right now to fund the six-month expeditions that we really need to get out there and just have somebody live in the woods to find these things.
Coming from Decatur, you must have been familiar with Alton, Illinois.
Oh, yeah, Alton and the Piazza bird and
yep,
all of that. Oh, yeah, that's definitely, as you know, on the cliffs of Alton, there's the ancient painting of a giant bird, and that was known up and down the Mississippi River, and then up the Missouri and up the Illinois. These creatures flew the rivers, and the native peoples decided to paint one of them on the side of the hill. And it was something that when they went by in their boats and their canoes, they had to really revere this and really were quiet and bowed down to this this drawing.
Legend has it that he attacked an Indian chief, and they had to fight him off.
Exactly, and spears and cliffs and everything, a giant battle that really comes down through many lore.
I'm convinced in St. Louis, my son must have been about 8 years old, and we had a creek going behind our house and then some woods, and he was on the other side of the creek on our side, and he thinks he saw, and this is coming from the mind of a little kid at the time, but he thinks he saw, Lauren, a huge bird. And I laughed at him because I wasn't aware of this at the time. Mm-hmm. And this is 1988, I think. He said, "Dad, this thing was huge, and it flapped its wings in the woods, and it left. But I could still hear it, you know." And, you know, I laughed, but you know what? Who's to say the kid didn't see something like that?
Exactly. And if you look at the reports, the two major flaps, as we call them, the series of reports from 1948 around Alton, Illinois, and 1977 around Lawndale, Illinois. Both have involved in the beginnings reports from children. And it's almost as if children without any of the bias and prejudice look up. And most adults don't look up anymore. And here they're seeing them, and then other people start reporting them. The 1948 series around Alton, Illinois and East St. Louis were so important that the associate mayor of East St. Louis and did a proclamation to try to hunt it. There were so many reports of it.
How big do you think an egg would be to one of these birds, to these birds?
I think the eggs are probably about the size of an ostrich egg, quite large. Yet, we really don't know. We don't know what their eggs could be like. We certainly, the people that, the stories that I dug up from 1948, people were talking about them the size of a Cessna, just like the reports from Alaska. So large that people said that they were standing in a second floor building and looked out and saw this thing coming by, and they thought it was an airplane until it flapped its wings.
You have to assume that they saw something, that this is not just myth.
Right. It was a psychiatrist, actually, a pretty reputable eyewitness who did that report. Besides, what happened is she filed a report, and then after that, some other people, including a young child, who had seen it a week before but was afraid to tell anybody, came forth and started documenting their reports, too.
And these aren't condors?
No, they're not condors. Condors really, the Andean condor, live in the Andes, and the California condor, they look different. They're somewhat like them. The Illinois
Thunderbirds. They're not as big, right?
The condors aren't as big. These are bigger creatures, and yet they have the... What's interesting is the California condors doesn't have a white ring around its neck, and yet these Thunderbird reports do, and that matches up with the Andean condor. So the South American condor looks more like the Thunderbirds that are being reported from the Midwest than actually the California condor.
Could they be some mishap of nature?
No, I mean, I think it would be so unusual to find a bunch of Andean condors in the middle of Illinois. It's almost, even though more unbelievable, it's almost more believable that there's probably this breeding population of these large birds that have been here for thousands of years and are intelligent. They keep on the top of some very desolate mountains in the Carolinas, in the Poconos, in the Appalachians, in the Ozarks, and they occasionally, it takes a person to have a sighting, and these birds are around all the time, but the human beings aren't.
Anybody ever report getting their car hit by one of these or anything like that?
What we know from the reports around Appalachia, you know, the reports from Point Pleasant that really merge with the Mothman, people talk about these birds using cars and the kind of the flow pattern from cars to actually fly behind the cars who are very closely above them. And tracking back 100 years, you find the same kind of reports from horse and buggies and from jalopies, that these large birds actually use the aerodynamic flows that are around cars. And maybe even that's why they're called Thunderbirds, because they're using the thermals from thunderstorms to actually hide themselves and fly from area to area.
And now I know why Ford Motor Company had the car called Thunderbird.
Exactly. Yep.
There it is. Stay with us, Lauren. Much more to go when we come back. Plus, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you're interested in being part of donating some of your funds when you get your free book, Worker in the Light, and it's not free, but the money will be free to those needy Coast to Coast listeners when you purchase it, you can go to Amazon.com. They're taking pre-orders. The book is out September 19th. It's called Worker in the Light. And if you want to pick that up, they'll ship it right out to you at the appropriate time. And again, part of the proceeds going to needy coasttocoastam.com listeners. Lauren, I've heard a lot about strange creatures, but what the heck is Lizard Man all about?
Well, Lizard Man is a umbrella term for these creatures that are about 5.5 to 6.5 feet tall. They're seen really all over the world, but we talk about them a lot in North America around the Ohio Valley. They're also South Carolina, North Carolina, greenish creatures. You know, look like they're covered in scales, but maybe they're just covered in hair that has algae on them. Anyway, you know, there's not that many of them. There's not that many reports. There's, you know, the reports from 1958 in Riverside, California, when a Charlie Witzel came across this creature that was crossing a stream, and it gave a screech that he said he will never forget. He got the gun out of his glove compartment, went for the gun, and before he knew it, the creature had apparently got rolled under his car, and he took off. And so that kind of creature, Lizard Man, have been reported. It's almost as if they are like the creatures from the Black Lagoon. They have that Gillman look to them. And yet, police officers in Ohio have seen ones that they called the Frogman. There were the ones in California. There was some in a swampy area in South Carolina that was seen just 10 years ago or so. So we know that there's these reports, and it doesn't seem to be anything to do with the reptilian political situation that we hear from some people that have been on different radio shows.
What are the possibilities, Lauren, that somebody's dressing up in a costume and he looks like a lizard?
Well, definitely that's always a possibility in cryptozoology, you know, whether it's a Bigfoot, whether it's a Lizard Man. But the unfortunate thing is that people have guns and they're shooting at some of these creatures.
Yes, you're right.
And so I think that what we're finding is that, yes, the pranks that are being conducted are usually ones in which there are other teenagers involved, that it may be the side of a road, and you don't get these reports where hunters are coming across them or they're surprising people who are, you know, like police officers or individuals that may have guns. And that's, for instance, the Ohio reports from the 1970s. These are police officers that had guns and came across this creature that was crouching next to the road, apparently eating a rabbit or something, and they're one motion away from using their guns and shooting at it. So I think that yes, there are some people that are doing the Halloween pranks, but they don't seem to be the basis of a lot of these reports.
What is it about the human psyche, Lauren, that wants them to shoot first, ask questions later?
I think it's a well, you know, a lot of people are hunters, and that's I'm not disputing that, but there's another part of those individuals with handguns and rifles that seem to go to that direction as far as their own fears. The fear of the unknown sometimes is best dealt with, I think, with some individuals through guns. Other people, of course, use flight, and they get out of there as soon as they can. So, then there is a small contingent, for instance, of Bigfoot hunters that want to prove the Bigfoot exists, and they're out to shoot them, to kill them, to prove it. And, of course, the whole myth that if you shoot a Bigfoot, the person that shoots a Bigfoot and proves it will get $1 million, I think that it probably will cause more grief than rewards in the long run. But we'll see.
What would you tell a bunch of hunters who are out there trying to shoot a Bigfoot and you happen to be out there with them?
Well, I think that I would encourage them to use cameras first to use live traps, to use tranquilizer guns. We don't exactly know what a wounded Bigfoot does. Does it attack someone? Does it? It's interesting that the Native Americans from the East Coast, when they talked about the Wendigo, they also talked about it as the stone giant, because what these creatures would do, they would get in pine pitch and resin and roll in different kinds of stones and pebbles, therefore giving themselves some protection from weapons of humans. So they may actually, some of these Bigfoot may have a sort of a armor on their body, and they may not be easily killed.
What's a Yowie?
A Yowie. Yowie is a specific name for the Australian Bigfoot. But they're kind of a little bit different looking. They tend to have teeth that are pretty rangy, and they have pot bellies. So the Yowies have also been around since the 1800s down there in Australia.
Pot bellies?
Yeah, they have pot bellies. So they're kind of they look pretty uncomfortable.
I would guess so. I mean, what kind of creatures do they look like today?
They look like, I mean, for the Australians, that's their form of Bigfoot. And yet, if you look at some of the old drawings from the 1800s, the Australian Aborigines would often describe them as not having hair on certain parts of their chest, having a pot-like belly, having toes that kind of were much more stretched out. And interestingly, using clubs and some forms of weapons in a different way than you hear about with Bigfoot.
Do chimpanzees have pot bellies? A little bit they do, the way
yeah,
they walk.
Yeah, most of the vegetarian primates tend to have pot bellies. So if a creature is reported with a pot belly, I tend to think that they have less meat in their diet and more vegetables.
Why would that be?
The high carbohydrates in the pure vegetarian diets tend to go right to the belly of mostly males.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yep. Yeah, whereas
that's why I work out, Lorne, to keep that from happening.
That's good, especially since you know, your line of work, you have to sit down a lot.
Actually, I stand when I do the program most of the time, believe it
or
not.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's a great idea.
Okay, so of every creature you've investigated, and they're all mysteries, why is it that we can't find any of them? We can't get the cats. We can't get Bigfoot. We can't get the Thunderbird.
But we do. And as soon as we find a creature, it's no longer part of cryptozoology. It's part of zoology. And so you don't hear about it from cryptozoologists, but, you know, the coelacanth, it was an unknown animal before 1938, the megamouth shark, 1976, you know, the okapi, 1901. All of these creatures, you know, the sola, which is the goat-like antelope found in the 1990s in Vietnam, all of these animals, these mystery animals that were fantastic, the kraken, the huge creature that roamed the oceans and brought ships down, we know today as the giant squid. They were monstrous. They were fantastic creatures of cryptozoology and of romantic zoology until they're discovered, and then you don't hear about them from cryptozoologists. So, of course, the big ones, the big three, the Loch Ness Monster, Abominable Snowman, and Bigfoot haven't been discovered yet. But as I keep reminding people in the talks that I'm giving around the country at universities, we now know that little people are real. We have fossils of them. People always say, well, show us the bones. Well, we found bones. We have 7 to 9 individuals, these little people, these hobbits, the Homo
erectus. About 3 feet tall, right?
3 feet tall. And just think about it. The pygmies that we know about are 5 feet tall. These are 3 feet tall, full-grown adults who probably were covered in hair, lived in caves, and we still hear about them in the folklore of the Flores Islands in Indonesia. There are probably other people around. If you've gone to Hawaii, you've probably bumped into the tales of the Minihune. And the Minihune are the little people of Hawaii who probably have a direct legacy connected to the hobbits of Flory's Island. Little people are real now, and that was just as fantastic as Bigfoot was, you know, in the 1920s.
Might they have been the leprechauns of the Irish lore?
Yeah, anthropologist named Carlton Kuhn, who died in the 70s, but was a friend of mine, he used to talk about the little people tales. If you look at a map, you'll notice that at the edges of the islands, you have here the Negritos in the islands of Oceania. You have the little people on Flory's Islands. You have the leprechauns in Ireland. If you look at the map, the way he talked about it is Homo sapiens, modern human beings, came upon the scene and they pushed these relic surviving populations to the edge of the map. And it just exactly is painted out that way.
Let's spend some time to the top of the hour. Mothman. Any more cases?
Well, Mothman is seen all the time. The logical notion is that they all disappeared in 1967 when the Silver Bridge collapsed at Point Pleasant. But I've talked to individuals there. There's this overlap between the Mothman cases and the Thunderbird cases. And people are still seeing this creature that almost looks like more like a giant owl than a giant bird, traditional Thunderbird.
Is that possible, Lorne, a giant owl?
We know that there's in the fossil record from Cuba, there's a giant owl that was about 3.5-4 feet tall. And what I find over and over again is that most eyewitnesses who see something in the dark, who have been surprised by something, naturally exaggerate. The cryptozoologist Bernard Heuvelmans felt that most animals that are covered in hair that are seen in the dark are exaggerated by one-third. So if we're saying that there's possibly a giant owl that is living in the Appalachia area in Point Pleasant, and people are saying that it's 5 feet tall, 6 feet tall, I think that we may have something that's 4 feet tall there, unknown owl that hasn't been discovered yet, yet lives in the mines, lives in the abandoned buildings, certainly in some of the larger hilltops around that area.
And that's still a pretty big bird.
Still a big bird. I wouldn't want to run into a four-foot-tall owl.
No, not at all. Do you ever investigate extraterrestrial reports that people say, look, they've landed and they're running around my backyard or anything like that?
Well, George, you can well imagine people tell me anything.
Anything, sure.
You know, they tell me anything that's unusual. And I'm a really open listener. I go into an area when I was, for instance, investigating the Dover demon, which is this little orange creature about 4 feet tall with a shape of the head of a figure eight, about a watermelon-sized head in Dover, Massachusetts. When I went in investigating that case, people who had UFO sightings, people had talked about old traditions of a headless horseman in that mm-hmm. area. They had Bigfoot reports. So I really want to be open to listening to all the reports, because what I often find, if you find one kind of phenomena, Fortean phenomena, anomalous phenomena in an area, you oftentimes find that that's what John Keel would call a window area. It's almost as if it's an area that's magnetic to the unknown. And, I document all of that. I listen to it. I don't try to dispute it, or I don't investigate it. I get my UFO friends to come in and investigate the UFO part, and I stick with the animals.
What part of your investigations of cryptozoology do you find the most fascinating?
Well, I think what I find encouraging is how interested people are still in being open to the unknown. There are people seeing new animals all the time. It's very encouraging to me, and on a planet in which extinctions are very real, that we still are discovering new animals, and I find that quite encouraging. And considering that in 1960, when I started, hardly anybody in the East was interested in cryptozoology, and and how so many people are interested in cryptozoology now, that tells me that this is an interesting part of natural history studies that people have gone into.
Isn't it amazing that they are finding all these new animals and plants and other species? It's almost as if this planet has an endless abundance of life. When you think about it, Lauren, look how many creatures there are on this planet.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Millions and millions of creatures being discovered, you know, insects, microbes, all of those. But when you pick up the newspaper and find out that 7 new frogs have been discovered in New Guinea, or a new spider has been found in the Himalayas, it gives you hope that we haven't discovered everything, and we haven't even touched the oceans. I mean, I think sea serpents certainly are going to be discovered. They may be called something different by the zoologists who classify it, but I think that what people have been seeing and calling sea serpents are out there. They're in the oceans. The oceans are the best body of data for new animals, and really have some big surprises in store for us.
Steve Alton, the author of The Loch, thinks that the Loch Ness Monster is a truly huge eel. He came by last week with a picture, and it was huge.
Yeah, well, I know there are a lot of eels in Loch Ness. I think, though, from the people I've talked through down through the years from Loch Ness and the old cases I've studied, there's too many reports of people saying they see hair, they see eyebrows, they see breathing. The eels move side to side like a fish, and the reports of the Loch Ness Monster show this creature goes up and down like a mammal. So, I respect what Steve's trying to do in his fiction book and his eel theory, but I really am firmly in the mammal camp for the Loch Ness Monster.
If it exists, or do you believe it does exist?
Oh, I don't think that there's any doubt that they exist, and I think, though, that the whole idea that there's one Loch Ness Monster, or that it's thousands of years old, there's a breeding population, and I think that, you know, the 20 or so cases of them being seen on land or crossing the roads around Loch Ness, the ocean at the end of Loch Ness is only 6-7 miles away, and I think that there's a good possibility that we've got communication between the oceans and Loch Ness, almost as if they are the giant salmon monsters that are coming back every year to breed. I think it's foolish to think that Loch Ness has a creature that isn't mobile, that isn't moving around, and is landlocked. It's just it's too close to the oceans to think that.
Now, I don't mean ancestors here, but do you think it's possible one day we'll find dinosaurs living either, you know, in the Malaysia area or Brazil or the Congo?
I think the best bet is probably the Congo. Those seem to be theropods. Those seem to be dinosaurs. And certainly, you know, I think they're mixed up there with some reports of some aquatic rhinos. But certainly the expeditions that have gone there seem to be very encouraging that the pygmies are seeing something that looked like dinosaurs to them. So maybe we should, you know, start there. And that would, I mean, after all, alligators, crocodiles are left over from the age of dinosaurs. The coelacanth is, too, and there's no doubt that there may be some large dinosaur-like creatures around.
All right, stay with us. We're going to take phone calls now next hour. Creature Time on Coast to Coast AM.